Today, the government is playing tough with the BBC, but will the broadcaster fight back? And living with endometriosis. During the general election, there were fierce accusations of bias against the BBC from both the left.
If the BBC are going to hold themselves out as somehow having conducted themselves in an impartial manner, I think they've really got to have a look in the mirror.
And the right.
The BBC doesn't want to hear a lot of things which the wider population keeps telling them. And I feel that in particular, the whole Brexit story is a test which the BBC has utterly failed.
Heated confrontations began a conflict between the corporation and the Conservative government. Boris Johnson's victory was not the end of that story.
It is coming up to 23 minutes past eight. Boris Johnson sets out his programme for government in the Queen's speech today. We'd like to interview a minister about his plans, the plans for the next year. But Downing Street says that no minister is available.
This is an increasingly familiar sound in parts of the BBC these days. An apparent government boycott of some of the broadcaster's highest profile political programmes, which began in the wake of the election, appear to be continuing. And meanwhile, ministers are looking into plans to change elements of the corporation's funding model. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, will the BBC fight back against Boris Johnson's government? Jim Waterson, you're The Guardian's media editor. The BBC had a pretty rocky general election, didn't it?
There's lots of things that happened to the BBC in an election campaign, and it became sort of the punch bag for all sides. Its attempt to be an independent referee in the middle of a really unpleasant fight and its own failings mixed together to create enough moments that were quite awkward for the broadcaster. You started with little things like there was the moment where they accidentally used the wrong footage of Boris Johnson laying a wreath at the cenotaph.
Those pictures shown three times during Monday's breakfast at half past the hour during the summaries were in fact from 2016.
You know, in the scale of things might not be that big, but when you see a clip of it on Twitter and you're told that this makes the PM look in a lot better shape than he actually was, then it feels like there's a sort of sense of bias somewhere in there.
And that wasn't the only minor thing, if you like. I mean, there was a news package in which they had edited out the laughing at Boris Johnson when he was asked a question on trust.
How important is it for someone in your position of power to always tell the truth?
I think it's absolutely vital.
As we know, was probably just because they had to do the news package in 2:10 or whatever it was. But again, Twitter was a lie, or where a political correspondent accidentally talked about Boris Johnson heading for
the majority that he so deserves, but
the victory he so deserved. I mean, did those things matter?
All of these things, I think, did end up mattering because they provided a way of blaming someone else for the way that things were going. They were mistakes. They were all mistakes that shouldn't have happened. The BBC says they shouldn't have happened. They hold their hands up and say, we shouldn't have done that. And there are questions on why you end up using the wrong footage, why you end up editing out a bit of laughter rather than something else. But there's a thing that the BBC are struggling with, which is that it wasn't built for this level of scrutiny of all of its output. If you think of the thousands of hours across 40 radio stations, several TV channels, all manner of web output that it put out during that election campaign, you just need to find one thing a day that they messed up, and you've got a story that will explode all over the internet as an example of bias. And the great thing, if you're into your politics and you're obsessive about it, is there'll always be some cock-up somewhere in the system that you can latch onto as an explanation or an example of bias against your particular candidate.
Okay, they sound like largely honest mistakes. Let's talk about something of a different and arguably more serious nature, about the way the BBC uses social media. 3 days out from the election, political editor Laura Koonsberg, and to be fair, others at different broadcasters, wrote a tweet suggesting a Labour activist had punched a Tory aide outside Leeds General Hospital. But then a video emerged showing there were protesters heckling Health Secretary Matt Hancock and his aides, but there was no punch. She quickly apologised, but it raised really serious questions about how platforms like Twitter are used, especially by someone with a million followers.
Time and time again, we're coming up against this. So to get your newsline onto the News at 10, leading the BBC's main news bulletin, we'll go through so many editors, so many questions. Have you got that right? Is that double checked? Have you got the footage in the right order? Is that all good? And yet a correspondent who can have hundreds of thousands of Twitter followers doesn't really have any editorial control, and they can just fire off thoughts, fire off things that they're hearing. And this is a real conundrum. Do they engage with this world where fast is good and second is nothing? And it's often senior BBC correspondents, often quite old school ones, sounding off on Twitter that really anger junior BBC correspondents who know that they couldn't get away with anything like that. Andrew Neil often comes up. Andrew Neil, who is seen as a brilliant interviewer on TV, but on Twitter will often be wading into arguments, promoting articles from The Spectator, which he chairs, and things like that, which push the boundaries in a way that junior members of staff wouldn't be able to get away with.
On December the 12th, voters will go to the polls to decide who will represent them in Parliament and who will lead the country at this critical time in our history.
Speaking of Andrew Neil as a fierce interviewer, I mean, he was at the centre of perhaps the most controversial issue for the BBC during the election.
Tonight I'm joined by the leader of the Labour Party, the man who wants to be Prime Minister, Jeremy Corbyn.
Neil had invited Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn onto his show and gave him a really hard time.
That can be constructed as being an anti-Semitic statement.
Right, but let's just get it clear. And therefore should I asked you, used. I gave you a specific quote. Mm-hmm. Are the words Rothschild Zionists run Israel and world government, that anti-Semitic?
It should not be used, and it is.
But you can't say it's anti-Semitic.
No, look, I just said that it should not be used.
That's different from it being anti-Semitic. There's lots of things shouldn't be used, but that's not the same as anti-Semitic. Is it or isn't it anti-Semitic?
Andrew, it is an anti-Semitic trope that has been used. And that was...
It then emerged that he hadn't secured an interview with the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, but Labour hadn't realised that. Neil called the Prime Minister out with a slightly weird but kind of brilliant monologue.
We've always proceeded in good faith that the leaders would participate. And in every election, they have. All of them. Until this one. It is not too late. We have an interview prepared, oven ready, as Mr. Johnson likes to say. The theme running through our questions is trust, and why at so many times in his career, in politics and journalism, critics and sometimes even those close to him have deemed him to be untrustworthy.
Which some thought was pushing the boundaries of impartiality. And initially, the BBC refused to take Johnson on other platforms.
This morning, I'm joined by the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, and from the Labour Party...
But then, suddenly, after the terror attack on London Bridge, they changed their minds and let him appear on the Andrew Marr show. And at the time, that caused most anger from people on the left who had seen Marr as an easier interview than Andrew Neil. And it was the left that had been furious about the previous incidents. But that wasn't borne out in the response from viewers, was it?
One of the strangest things, and perhaps if you're a Guardian reader and you're a Labour supporter listening to this, you will maybe have been left with the impression from your social media feeds that almost everyone in the country had clearly noticed that the BBC was biased against Labour. And instead, when you look at the complaints log from people who actually took the time to write in, the vast majority of big complaints were about bias against the Conservatives, bias against Brexit, bias against Boris Johnson. About 12,000 people wrote in to say that Andrew Marr had been unfairly interrupting the Prime Minister when he finally appeared on his show.
Actually, that's not true.
No, it's seed money
We're putting
for business
in
plans
the seed money for 40 new hospitals.
Okay, and okay. As a result, Prime Minister, one thing we can all agree.
Taken by this government,
one thing we
there
can
will be
all
40 okay. more hospitals in 10 years' time. Well, I'm immensely proud of that.
One thing
this
we can all
embark
I'm sorry,
on a new
I'm
direction
sorry.
For this country.
I'm sorry, but
I think Andrew Marr was under a lot of pressure in that interview.
Poor Andrew Marr in that interview. I mean, imagine having to beg someone to go on a different person's interview. I mean, that's a pretty low point for your ego when you're there.
Why are you avoiding being interviewed by Andrew Neil?
Because I think we've got a perfectly brilliant Andrew.
You're absolutely right, but it's a different audience.
Obviously, this is still small slivers of the population, and probably the vast majority of people were just going about their business, turning on Radio 2 occasionally and hearing the headlines. But for the politically engaged, there is a deep, deep conviction that in some way the BBC is working against their interests.
It's a nightmare.
It's a complete nightmare. It's like all the neurosis of the whole country has been directed at one institution trying to act as an honest broker in a political world which really doesn't really reward honest brokers.
Tony Hall, the Director General of the BBC, argues that getting it in the neck from all sides is evidence of impartiality. Now, not everyone agrees with that logic, but either way, we now have a much more powerful government that seems determined to take action against a number of media outlets, but particularly some high-profile parts of the BBC. It's been reported that the government is boycotting Radio 4's flagship Today programme. Is that true?
Well, there's not been any ministers on the Today programme so far this year. You'll find ministers on Five Live.
What about the Big Ben Bong Ding Dong?
Yeah.
Will you be shaking a tin? What's your message? Just finally, before you go, Matt, what's your message to
bong
people?
Or no bong, we're delivering Brexit on the 31st of January.
Bong or no bong, but you didn't inhale. What's your...
You'll find ministers on BBC Breakfast.
Good morning, Louise. Morning, everybody. Yes, as promised, the Prime Minister is with us this morning. Mr.
Good morning,
Johnson,
Dan.
Thank you
good
very
morning,
much
morning,
for spending
morning.
A bit of time with us today.
Thank you very much for coming.
Well, it's nice to open up the doors to number 10 for us this morning.
Sitting there with Dan Walker, you saw the Prime Minister do that the other day. What you won't see is them talking to what Dom Cummings likes to describe as the Westminster bubble who listen to the Today programme.
You talk about Boris Johnson's chief strategist, Dom Cummings, thinking that the Today programme is speaking to the bubble. I mean, millions of people listen to the Today programme every morning. And no disrespect to Dan Walker on BBC Breakfast, but he is no Nick Robinson or Andrew Neil when it comes to an interview. I mean, that wasn't a difficult situation for Boris Johnson to find himself in.
During the campaign to become Conservative leader, we were told that you went vegan. Are you doing veganuary?
No, I'm not. No, I'm not. I had thought of it, but it requires so much concentration. I do, you know, I haven't got to.
Bacon sandwiches? What is it? What's the problem?
The whole lot. Doubtless somebody will send me a... I mean, you can't eat cheese, can you? You can't eat cheese if you're a vegan.
It's an issue.
I mean, it's just a crime against, you know... crime against cheese lovers.
And so, essentially, we've come to a situation where the government... an emboldened government because of that election result feels that it has the right to demand who it gets interviewed by and when it gets interviewed. I mean, Sarah Sands, who's the editor of the Today programme, says...
Well, what's happened is that you can see the government won a big majority. It sees Labour in disarray and it thinks it's a pretty good time to put the foot on the windpipe of an independent broadcaster. So the strategy, as we know, is to quite Trumpian to delegitimise the BBC.
Sounds about right. I mean, yeah, that's what they're doing, and they can. This is the thing that we need to sometimes deal with as journalists, rather than going, well, they must subject themselves to our scrutiny. They have shown that they can avoid it, and we've got to think of new ways of dealing with that. It's a real challenge because the structures were built that the only way for politicians to reach the public was through the BBC or maybe ITV as well. And when that no longer is the default, when there is the ability to go to the audiences in a different way directly...
They're welcome to come on Today and Focus.
I'm sure
anytime.
You'd love them on.
Boris Johnson, here's my invitation to you. I mean, it is quite scary for democracy. Margaret Thatcher and David Cameron, two former Conservative leaders, put themselves up to much more scrutiny than Boris Johnson's prepared to do.
Again, we're diagnosing the problem and we can't really come up with a really good answer. It's not just a BBC thing. The BBC is maybe the only place that can still have such a big audience that it can exert this power. So it's up to the people at the very top. Does Tony Hall, does Fran Unsworth, the head of News and Current Affairs, does Kamal Ahmed want this fight? Do they want to say, you can't come on any BBC programme unless you start putting the PM up on our really tough politics shows?
Come through here. This is our Today in Focus studio.
What do you think of it?
Nice.
I think they're kind of more gleaming than BBC studios.
Yeah, they're much nicer. You see ours, ours is held together with gaffer tape. They're slightly more, yeah.
Although actually, apparently it's a really good idea. Kamal Ahmed, you're the editorial director of BBC News, and we've just been discussing the government ostensibly boycotting your flagship political radio programme. But you could act, couldn't you? I mean, why are you letting Boris Johnson pick his interviewers? If he refuses to face Michelle Hussein on the Today programme, why is he allowed a more relaxed sit-down with Dan Walker on BBC Breakfast?
I wouldn't say it's more relaxed. I'd say it was different. Something like Breakfast is really important for the Breakfast audience. And it's really important they see the Prime Minister. He gave us half an hour of time. It enabled Dan Walker to talk to him about a wide range of issues. From Iran to whether Big Ben should chime on January the 31st to veganism and whether the Prime Minister liked cheese.
Veganism, as he put it.
So I think Anoushka, it's really important that our different audiences are able to see the Prime Minister. The Today audience, as you say, is incredibly important. And of course, you know, we want all politicians to appear on it. But we don't want to be in a position where we have some notion of a blanket ban on the Prime Minister not appearing on the country's leading media organisation. I don't think that would be appropriate.
And these decisions can really affect your reputation. I mean, if we rewind a bit back to the election, the highest profile instance of this was the Andrew Neil, Andrew Marr debacle. I mean, whatever the justification, it did look like that gave Boris Johnson an unfair advantage in the middle of a general election campaign.
Why do you say unfair? Why was it an unfair advantage?
Because just days earlier, the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, had been torn apart by your fiercest interviewer, believing that the Conservatives were going to be given the same treatment.
I think we look at it a bit differently. Jeremy Corbyn put himself up for scrutiny. He answered questions that Andrew Neil put to him. It's your judgment that he tore him apart. Jeremy Corbyn did an interview which was a serious piece of television and enabled people to understand the type of person Jeremy Corbyn is.
So
you're saying that's a negative that somehow Boris Johnson gained from not doing something that the public really appreciate. I would say that politicians gain from doing things the public appreciates. So why you're describing that as an advantage to Boris Johnson, I'm not sure.
I think we can agree that Jeremy Corbyn didn't come out of it well. The headlines that followed that interview were not favourable to the Labour leader.
I don't think we know what the public took from that interview.
You're essentially saying you don't have any leverage in this situation, that if the government chooses to boycott a particular programme, and let's be honest, they're doing this to other broadcasters as well, then so be it.
I don't think I said we don't have any leverage in this. We can't order the Prime Minister to appear on anything, but we have to leave it to the public to have an opinion about what they take from the fact that some programmes aren't getting the Prime Minister or senior ministers, and other programmes are. It's not for us to make those type of decisions.
Can I ask you about social media? One of the other kind of high-profile points of the election, if you like, maybe amplified because of the way social media itself responded to it, was the decision of your political editor, Laura Koonsberg, and other journalists from other broadcasters to tweet about an alleged punch on the basis of Downing Street sources. And it's led to some serious questions about how we use these platforms, because they, of course, don't have the very rigorous fact-checking processes that you have across all your news output. Are you rethinking this?
There's a live conversation, I think, in all media organisations about social media and how it's used. Mistakes are made on all, you know, we produce hundreds of hours of content a week. But the public thinks, well, out of all that coverage, all that expertise I've got from Laura, all those stories I've got from Laura, all that understanding I received from Laura, weighed up against one tweet, I think the balance is 99.99% in Laura's favour. And I think we need to manage the conversation in that way, not to say this is a crisis, social media is taking over everything. We need to have a bit of perspective.
But there is just that point at the heart of that, which is that mistake would never have happened on the 10 o'clock news, but it can happen very easily to any one of us on social media.
But you're right that there are different approaches, but live digital reporting is part of what we do now, Anishka. We don't just have the 10 o'clock news. We have to engage with audiences where they are, as well as audiences that in their millions come to the 10 o'clock news or the 6 o'clock news. And a lot of our audiences engage with us via digital platforms, so it's right that we're there. And on those platforms, it is a faster moving environment. I think there are three moments that people have touched on, Laura and the punch being one of them. They don't add up to a case. They add up to three moments for an organization that produces hundreds of hours of content a week and does it brilliantly for so many millions of people. You know, we had 27 million people came to our website and digital services on the day after the election to look at what happened and trust us to provide that in an impartial way. And I don't think that approach is defeated by three incidents that were leapt upon by some people to try and make a case against us, which I think you've admitted, Anishka, doesn't stand up to be a case that we are biased.
I mean, the government boycotting the Today programme is one thing, but this government is full of people who have for many years questioned how the BBC is funded. A week after the Andrew Neil controversy, Boris Johnson directly questioned the legitimacy of the licence fee system.
Why don't you abolish TV licence fees?
For everybody? Well, I don't think at this late stage in the campaign I'm going to make an unfunded spending commitment like that. And what I will say is that I'm under pressure not to extemporise policy on the hoof. But you have to ask yourself whether that kind of approach to funding a TV, a media organisation, still makes sense in the long term, given the way other organisations manage to fund themselves. That's all I will say. I think the system of funding out of what is effectively a general tax, isn't it? Everybody has a TV. It bears reflection. Let me put it that way. How long can you justify a system whereby everybody who has a TV has to pay to fund a particular set of TV and radio channels? That is the
We're talking about an existential threat here, aren't we?
Discussions about the future of the BBC have been around for as long as the BBC has been around. We have to be open to those discussions. We at BBC News are very aware we need to ensure that the public value what we do and realise why it's different and therefore funded differently. And that's really important. And it's really important, and we talk about it all the time. How do we ensure that the BBC is distinctive? The first word in our strategy is distinctive. We have to ensure that we are different and give people something that they value. And all the research reveals they value it. And that is indelibly linked to the way we are funded. And also in news, really importantly, news that has a duty to impartiality. It is in our every discussion we have is the notion of judgment, weighing up arguments, allowing audiences to decide what they think about key issues.
Jim, we've spent most of this programme talking about pressure on the BBC over its news coverage. But in reality, the BBC is way bigger than just news. It's about comedy, music, drama, entertainment. Is there an argument that the biggest threat right now to the BBC isn't a new government itching for a fight, but the way the international media landscape is dramatically changing?
The thing about the BBC is it was regulated and it's dealt with by the government as if it was the biggest beast in the room because it completely dominates the UK media scene.
And then in reality, it's now a much smaller beast because it's competing on a global stage with Netflix, Amazon and whoever for all the rights to shows and the budgets for dramas that have gone through the roof because Netflix will be easily able to outspend the BBC on everything. So you've got this odd situation where, for instance, if you're listening to this and you've ever tried to go on iPlayer and watch something that went on air more than 30 days ago, until recently it was a nightmare. There'd be whole series where big budget episodes had fallen off iPlayer before you'd even started watching it. And so you'd just basically give up and go, well, let's see what's on Netflix then. And now the BBC's finally got permission to put most of its shows on there for up to a year, which is going to make it a place where hopefully can start to compete with Netflix in terms of the expectations of younger viewers. And it's the same with BBC Sounds. They're going, well, you know, everyone else is listening to podcasts. Maybe our radio output isn't keeping pace with that. Let's go big into podcasts. So there are all sorts of conundrums. Like, do you protect the BBC at all costs? Because for the sort of sake of a British cultural experience, it's good that it's all dominant. Or do you go, well, actually, if punters are happy getting their music from Spotify, if they're happy getting much of their drama from Netflix, if they're happy getting their podcast from The Guardian, do you need it to be doing everything? And that's where you start to see an alignment of some of the... That was the argument often made from the right, but you're seeing people on the left making that now in a way that you wouldn't have done before.
But for all that, and I do hope that people get their podcasts from The Guardian over the BBC, or at least look to us as well, there's clearly a lot of great programming that comes from the BBC. There's clearly a lot of love from the BBC. There's a certain type of program that you probably don't get on Netflix or Amazon or even on certain outlets on Sky. This feels quite existential in a way, what's going on at the moment. Isn't it right that people should be looking at ways to protect such a beloved institution in this country at this time?
The case for the defence of the BBC is that there is nothing that could replace some of the services that it provides. There's no one who's going to fund a load of talk local radio stations. There's no one who's going to put that amount of money for commercial gain into news production. There's no one who's going to sit there and go, what we need is to develop young writers and give them shorts on BBC Three and then a proper programme on BBC Two and then put something big on iPlayer. That there is stuff that it does that no one else would do, and you won't know what you had until it's gone. That is quite hard to make the case for because people don't know what they've got until it's gone. And it's only when you actually say, well, we're going to have to close CBeebies and the entire...
Well, don't do that.
Well, exactly. Every parent in the land immediately goes, oh, I mean, I wanted to cut the BBC, but I didn't realise you meant CBeebies. Or the moment that the football fan who listens to the local radio commentary of a weekend on their home station goes, well, I wanted to cut the BBC, but I didn't mean I wanted you to take York City Live off air. Or that you listen to, you know, there's something for everyone that they would feel very, very strongly about it being cut, even if they'd be quite happy with decriminalisation of the licence fee and the BBC being curtailed in other areas. What you've got to see the BBC doing is making a stronger case for what it does, making sure that it's still reaching the population that it does, because there's a worrying drop-off in younger people who just aren't consuming any BBC content at all. It's not many, but it's a few and it's growing. And the real challenge is to make sure that at some level, there's something that people go, when you threaten the future of the BBC, oh, I'd be gutted if they stopped doing that.
Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Jim Waterson and the BBC News editorial director, Kamal Ahmed. Do read about this story on the website. Coming up, why a knowledge gap in medicine is putting women's health at risk. Now, 1 in 10 women around the world have endometriosis, a condition where the lining of the womb grows outside the womb itself, often causing chronic pain. Guardian Australia's associate news editor, Gabrielle Jackson, was diagnosed with the condition as a teenager, but it wasn't until her late 30s that she discovered that so many other health problems she was experiencing were connected to it.
Chronic pain is different to acute pain, which is pain from an injury, because it's not just the pain itself. Chronic pain involves other feelings, like when you get the flu. You're tired, you're fatigued, you sometimes feel dizzy or faint. So as well as dealing with this pain, which for me is often really sharp abdominal pain because my pain comes from endometriosis, sometimes the feeling of this intense nausea that I can't really get rid of or the fatigue, they're harder to deal with than the pain itself. For some reason, almost all the chronic diseases are more common in women and they feel pain for longer periods and more intensely than men. We don't really know why that is, but I think that that's probably the reason it hasn't been studied properly. There's a really big knowledge deficit about female biology in medicine. That's because, really, female biology has never really been studied. There's been some research into breasts and conditions of the uterus, mainly around fertility, but not much else. And that can play out in many ways. So it's not just that medicine doesn't know much about conditions that mainly affect women. It's that they don't know a lot about the ways that diseases that are common in both men and women affect women differently. Because medicine lacks this knowledge, they fill these gaps with what researchers call hysteria narratives. When women come with all these seemingly different things, oh, I'm a bit dizzy, I've got pain here, I get headaches, I feel nauseous, doctors just start to think that they're making it up. They don't really have the skills to realise that they're writing women off because there's a knowledge gap in medicine, not because women are just difficult or hysterical. For various reasons, women weren't even really included in clinical trials until the 1990s, and that was after a campaign by women because they realised that drugs were working differently in men and women. Now we're at a position where 70% of chronic pain patients are women, but 80% of pain drugs have been tested on men or male rodents. And there are a couple of reasons given for why women weren't included in clinical trials and why drugs weren't tested on them. One was that women's menstrual cycles or rodents' estrous cycles would interfere with the results. Another reason was that because women are born with all the eggs they'll ever produce, it could be dangerous to test on them because the drugs could potentially make them infertile. Which is ridiculous because once drugs are on the market, they're being sold to women and in a much less controlled environment where any adverse effects take longer to be recorded. Also, studies have shown that menstrual cycles and estrous cycles don't actually interfere with results. But if they do, it would be really good to know that before the drug was on the market. Sometimes people say, oh, well, women don't die of endometriosis or fibromyalgia, so we need to concentrate on the things that are killing us. But research has shown that there are higher suicide rates associated with chronic pain. Chronic pain causes depression and anxiety, and really we're being denied opportunities in our life. We're being denied the opportunity to live our full potential, and that can be devastating, not just for the individual women, but for their families, friends, and for society. There definitely needs to be more research into chronic pain and more research into particularly how female bodies process pain. In 2016, the National Institutes for Health, which is the largest government research funding body in the world, made a rule that any research they were funding into pain had to be done on both men and women or male and female rodents, or if only one sex could be tested, it had to be female rodents or human women. That needs to be a worldwide phenomenon. Otherwise, women will continue to live with these pain conditions, and it's really depriving us of our full humanity.
That was Gabrielle Jackson. My thanks to her and to Jim Waterson and Kamal Ahmed. Today's episode was produced by Josh Kelly, Courtney Youssef and Gregory Robinson. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.